Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm Hannah Strong.
And I'm Jack King.
On the show this week, writer-director Mike Mills teams up with Joaquin Phoenix for the poignant family drama Come On, Come On. We also have an interview with Mike Mills himself. Then Paolo Sorrentino returns with the striking Maradona-referencing semi-autobiographical coming-of-ager The Hand of God. And in Film Club, Jimmy Stewart's got mail in the classic Christmas romantic comedy, The Shop Around the Corner. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, welcome back, listeners. And Hannah, always a pleasure to podcast with you. How are things going for you? It's getting towards the end of the year. We're looking back at the year of film. Have you had to do your end of year list yet?
Put it together, much like Santa Claus. I've checked it twice. We're in the middle of all our end of year content, so it's very hectic. A lot of deadlines looming, and then a lot of obviously social engagements to fit in around that, and then obviously still like films coming thick and fast. We're still waiting on Nightmare Alley and Don't Look Up and The Matrix, like the big one, Spider-Man. Yeah, there's still some big hitters.
We've got some big films coming in the next couple of weeks.
Exciting times. I'm one of those people who doesn't really get in the festive spirit till like the week before Christmas. So for me, I'm still in work mode. But yeah, You know, busy month.
Well, we're getting into the festive spirit on the podcast where Film Club, for the next couple of episodes, will be Christmas themed, and we have The Shop Around the Corner this week. But before we get to that, Hannah, do you have any Christmas favourites in your world?
Not strictly. Well, I guess it is set at Christmas. I am a big fan of Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet. Little left field one. I don't know. I think as a teenager, I always used to watch it on Christmas Eve, so like made myself fall asleep because it's like 4 hours long. But it's just a good movie, you know. I think that Branagh gets a bad rap sometimes as a director, but his Hamlet's really great. Would highly recommend if people haven't seen it.
It is incredible, and it's very much got that bank holiday in between Christmas New Year kind of vibe where you just waste a whole day watching that film. I've never seen it on the big screen. I'd love to see it on the big screen because that's one where Branagh was really, he really wanted to do a David Lean style 70mm epic version of Hamlet.
I think he cheated.
Shakespeare scholars among us know that there are like, and yeah, Shakespeare scholars among us so know there are multiple versions
like
of Hamlet.
Hamlet and Macbeth, the only two Shakespeare plays that anyone cares about adapting.
But even on the page, there's the folio version, the quarter maximalist version of Hamlet. I'm going to put both together. It's going to be 4 hours long. And, you know, like, yeah, that's a good pick, Hannah. That's, I guess I'll clear out an afternoon or a long evening.
Can you imagine if we've been within a little peek behind the curtain for listeners. We've been choosing the film clubs kind of, I think I recommended next week's, even though I haven't seen it. I was just kind of like, oh, this would be a fun one. But yeah, imagine if I'd been like, let's do Hamlet, guys. Maybe we can do it when Macbeth comes out. That would be nice. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were going to say when Belfast comes out, because Branagh does have a film coming out in the new year.
Christmas-y. Oh, well, we'll figure it out. Everyone listening to this now is like, oh, you guys have done this in your meeting.
Of course, anyone who's seen the promotional materials for Belfast will see that that is a black and white film with a child acting performance at the heart of it. very shortly we'll be talking about Come On, Come On, another black and white film with a child acting performance at the heart of it. So stay tuned for that. But first, Jack King, welcome to Truth and Movies. This is always a very existential question. It might seem a bit interrogative at this time of the morning. But Jack, who are you? What do you do?
Oh, it's a question I ask myself every day. No, I am a film journalist. I write for outlets like Vulture and British GQ. And yeah, I, as everybody else on the podcast, I love the movies.
All the movies?
Oh, most of the movies. I particularly love the movies we're talking about today. They're actually two of my favourites of the year. Not to spoil any of our coming conversation, but yeah, no, I absolutely love both of them. I'm a big fan of Sorrentino and Mills, so oh, wow. Yeah, love them both.
So the dice roll has landed in your favour. That's fantastic. So
I've been incredibly lucky.
So I suppose without any further ado, we should crack on with this week's new releases, starting with Mike Mills' Come On, Come On. A little bit of setup here for Come On, Come On. Johnny, Joaquin Phoenix, and his young nephew, played by Woody Norman, forge a tenuous but transformational relationship when they are unexpectedly thrown together in this delicate story about the connections between adults, children, the past and the future, from writer-director Mike Mills. So Hannah, you had the opportunity to speak with Mike Mills. Do you want to tee up a clip from that interview? Or maybe also tell us who Mike Mills is and why we should be excited about who he is?
I would hope listeners know who Mike Mills is. Mike is an American filmmaker, very much of the kind of independent scene. He's been doing this for a long time now. His debut was in, I think, 2007 or something, Thumbsucker, and then he's made two other films, Beginners and 20th Century Women, both excellent. Thumbsucker's really good as well. And yeah, he's a really wonderful, very empathetic filmmaker, and I was really thrilled to get to talk to him. He's such a great interview, so open and warm and very funny as well. So yeah, we had quite this wide-ranging chat about everything, really. It was like therapy for me. But yeah, it was really nice. He's a great guy.
So here he is. Let's have a listen to Hannah speaking to Mike Mills.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
20th Century Women and Beginners are kind of very rooted in your own familial experiences, and I'm very curious as to how much of Come On, Come On is also kind of based on your own life and your relationship with your family.
I could, yeah, it definitely started with there. It's a similar world, so there's lots of scenes that really came out of things that happened between me and my kid, and but it's a little different this time around, because first time I'm dealing with someone who's alive and as a child, right? So I don't want to mess with them. And so I did find ways to create distance, like the uncle part of the story, and that they don't really know each other. But within that structure, there's nuggets that are very my kid. And they're all through the film. But once you start writing, the weird spiritual craziness of writing starts taking place, where you're not in control of what's happening and things are coming. You don't know exactly why and all that. And it's not just your kid anymore. It's like kind of going like that. And then you meet the actor, and especially the way I work with actors, I need them to make it theirs, right? I need it to get under their skin, get in their psyche, get in their bloodstream. So I'm doing everything I can to kind of like give it to them and have them take over and have them care, right? And have it feel alive. So like Woody is not my kid at all, right? And there's something really beautiful about that exchange of like Woody bringing his soul and psyche and history and timing and humor and cares, right? And taking this like baton, kind of like my version of my kid, and then running with it.
And there was Hannah speaking with Mike Mills. Thanks to Mike for joining us on the podcast. Hannah, talking there about kids in relation to Come On, Come On, I've heard this Woody Norman guy is a talent to watch. I hear he's good, right?
Yeah, he's fantastic. I'm very normally quite critical of child actors, just because I think that they can really, really like make or break a film. You know, if they're good, they're good. If they're bad, it just takes you out of it and you get quite distracted by how bad they are. But Woody is amazing in Come On, Come On. I said this to Mike in the interview, but he has this sort of world weariness that gives him the kind of image of being like a 40-year-old trapped in the body of a 9-year-old. He has this wonderful line delivery, and if you listen to any interviews with Mike Mills or read any interviews with Mike around the film, he talks about how Woody was very like a very professional actor and very kind of like came to set and knew his lines and did his marks, and Joaquin was kind of much goofier and sillier. And there's a wonderful moment, I think, in one of the kind of panels they've been doing, where Woody says to Joaquin, "I've been carrying you this whole time." And just, yeah, he's wonderful and British as well, which watching the film blew me away, because he does a really, really great American accent. I had no idea until I heard him speak at London Film Festival, and I was like, what? But yeah, a good year for child performances. And he really is the heart of this film. For the whole thing to work, you need to believe the relationship between him and Joaquin, because a lot of it is just the two of them hanging out, and they completely sell it. It's such a joy to kind of watch them interacting and watch the kind of conversations they have. And yeah, I was very taken with Woody as an actor.
And Joaquin as well. So off the back of something like Joker or You're Never Really Here, Joaquin Phoenix has been exploring sort of the darker side of himself on screen in recent films. This is a bit of a gear change. How does that play out?
Yeah, well, I'm a big Joaquin fan. I think he is one of the finest actors maybe ever, definitely of his generation. So I was really happy to see him doing something different, especially because I did not care for Joker, as I think listeners will know from Pamela and I's podcast all that time ago. But yeah, so the whole reason he took the role is because it was such a gear shift after he did Joker, which is why Mike Mills was able to convince him. And it works. It really, really works. There's this sort of tenderness and stuntedness to his character, and the transformation. I mean, it's one of those, we're not teaching kids, they're teaching us kind of films. But yeah, there's a real softness and a gentleness of touch that he is so good at when he kind of deigns to do that. You know, I'm thinking of like his performance in Her. I think there's definitely some kind of what would we say, like intertextuality between the two, and which makes sense because Spike Jones is really good friends with Mike Mills. But yeah, it's really refreshing to see him in a film where you can root for him properly, like heart and soul. You can be behind Johnny and want him to succeed in this kind of crazy world that he suddenly flung into. And it is like a proper ensemble piece, because you've got Woody and Joaquin, but you've also got Gabby Hoffman, who plays Johnny's sister, Jesse's mother, and she's amazing as well. It's I think Mike Mills is so great at writing female characters, which, God love him, male filmmakers aren't always the best at that, but he's got such a again, like a gentleness of touch. And Gabby is a real kind of delight in the film. You really believe the sibling relationship there, and it's very, very poignant the way it kind of, it's not only about Jesse and Johnny kind of growing closer, but also these two kind of estranged siblings learning to communicate with each other as adults and see each other as adults. And I was just very, it feels quite rare to see a film that is so tender and so kind of emotionally open without it feeling saccharine or emotionally manipulative. And I think that Mike is kind of a master at that. I don't think his films ever feel like they're trying to tug at your heartstrings just for effect.
I love Gabby Hoffman, just to say as a quick sidebar, and she's one of those, you know, there's the phenomenon of the that guy supporting actor. She's one of, you know, one of the female examples of that, but also has this long career. She was a child actor in the way that Joaquin Phoenix was, so there's that interesting off behind camera thing here of a great child performance alongside two child actors turned powerhouse adult actors. Jack, you kind of spoiled it for us here, saying that you were a fan of this film in the intro. What struck you about Come On, Come On?
What didn't strike me about Come On, Come On is probably the more apt and pertinent question. I mean, reason I've enjoyed Mills's work so much is because, I mean, as everybody here will be conscious of, I mean, cinema is meant to make you feel something. And I think he is just the epitome of this incredible empathy that cinema can capture at its very best. And Mills in himself is such an empathetic person, and Come On, Come On is just the kind of like the apex or the confluence of all of these different empathetic strands, where, you know, it's literally, you have these documentary moments where he goes to different kids in America in different cities, I think it's New Orleans, I think somewhere in California and New York. I haven't seen the film since the London Film Festival, unfortunately, but off the top of my head, it's the three big cities in America. And talks to all of these kids and just gets so much candor and just so much just enriching kind of like adolescent and youthful, not only about adolescent because it's younger, but like, you know, just like this childish honesty, where it's just kind of like, you know, we see the world through this film of adulthood, through this, you know, all the stresses and everything that we accumulate always going to influence our subjectivities and the way we see everything. But these kids are just kind of like, yeah, the world sucks, but it can get better. And it's like the world is, you know, in a pretty awful place, but hey, we're all really, 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 we feel great about the future. And I think for Mills to have so much trust in that perspective, and I think this goes into Woody and Jesse too, it really, really works. And as Hannah said earlier, I'm usually a bit of a child actor agnostic. I don't know if that's the correct word, or a skeptic more so. But my God, Woody Norman in this film is just absolutely incredible. Just absolutely incredible. Had a similar experience as well at London Film Festival. He walked out on the stage and started waxing eloquent in this wonderful English accent. And I was just like, where the hell did this guy come from? But no, just absolutely, absolutely phenomenal. And you've already spoken so much about Joaquin, so I won't tread over again. But it one of his best performances. I love all of his movies. I think The Through Line to Her is a really salient observation to make. Actually, he kind of has that a similar very similitude, but also, you know, just this kind of like solemnness, I think, to his character. But yeah, no, I think for it to really be this shot of empathy, like an EpiPen of empathy, but not to feel saccharine and not to feel indulgent, as Hannah already observed, like I was so taken to it. And by the end, I mean, I walked up to a friend of mine after the screening, and he kind of just looked at me and he just, you know, did the whole kind of like, "Are you okay?" in his eyes. And I just started bawling. I didn't stop bawling for about 10 minutes. So yeah, I was very affected.
It sounds like it.
I cried too. Oh, if goodness. You want a nice zesty cry, this week. Mm. Go and watch Come On, Come On.
Oh, I don't know if mine was zesty. Yeah, mine zesty. Was quite aggressive. I wailed.
Zesty's a word I got from Mike Mills.
Okay. I'm sure I'd love to have the breakdown of the different types of cry that you can have in films. That's maybe something for another day.
You said a zesty cry, and I thought that's a wonderful phrase.
Let's put some scores on Come On, Come On then. Hannah, I'll come to you first. This is out of 5, in anticipation, enjoyment, and then in retrospect.
I think my anticipation is probably a 4, because and the only reason it was a 4 is because I hated Joker so much. And I was kind of like down on Joaquin because of that. But really, I should have known better because it's Mike Mills. And my enjoyment and in retrospect, I've seen the film twice now. I'm probably going to go and see it again this weekend. It's both 5s for me. Confidently one of the best films of the year, and definitely one that I look forward to sharing with my family and people I care about. I think it's just such a there's a thing that Mike says in the interview about all his films being expressions or communications with people he loves, and I think that's such a really lovely way of describing his work, and I consider sharing his films a similar act of kind of love. So yeah.
Jack, your scores?
It's a funny one, because I had a conversation with some critic friends after seeing it, and it was just before I think I interviewed Mike myself, and I described myself as a bit of an agnostic to his previous films, including 20th Century Women, which I didn't really take to. But then I rewatched Beginners, and I was like, oh my god, this is incredible. So I mean, it was like a 3 going in. Because you know I didn't have a huge amount of huge amount of excitement, but 5s otherwise. I mean, I think it is handily my favorite film of the year, easily. I haven't seen anything to surpass it yet, and I don't think I will.
Well, I can't wait to see this film. Sounds like a strong recommendation from both of you. Listeners, if you do go and see Come On, Come On this weekend, let us know what you make of it at the usual channels, at LW Lies on Twitter, or Truth and Movies at tcolondon.com. Up next, we're off to 1980s Naples with The Hand of God. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Movies. Here's another podcast you can escape into. Life Sentence, a Mags Creative original, is an immersive audio journey and a powerful story of the climate crisis, with Jordan Stevens leading an incredible cast lending their voices to it. Time is ticking on this one, and you have to hear it to believe it.
You inherited a world of magnificent design, a tapestry woven of fine, quiet fabric. She was designed to live forever. In the beginning, it was perfect.
The Garden of Eden is no more.
I've left you lot alone for a while, and it looks like things are getting a bit messy.
I wanted to act as if the house was on fire, because it is.
Life Sentence, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Bit of synopsis here. In 1980s Naples, young Fabietto pursues his love of football as family tragedy strikes, shaping his uncertain but promising future as a filmmaker in this semi-autobiographical drama, the most personal yet, from director Paolo Sorrentino. So Jack, this is a semi-autobiographical drama from Paolo Sorrentino, so I guess up front we should cover, you know, why should we care? Who is Paolo Sorrentino? What are his big hits? I guess The Great Beauty might be one major touchstone for most people, but what's your take on him as a filmmaker?
I'm a big fan. Like it's like you already said, I really, really liked The Great Beauty. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I was a big fan. When I was in Venice a couple of years ago, they showed The New Pope as well, or a couple of episodes from The New Pope, so people know from that series. He also did The Young Pope with Jude Law. That was just really, really ravishing. He's just like, he's got this like such a fantastic and like stylish affect, I think, to his films, which is just so, so well, can be, not universally, but can be so vibrant and like, you know, kind of like style. But also with a lot of substance, you know, it's not just like this kind of like superficial gaudiness or something. I particularly took to those, and I've been a fan since. But I've got to say, I think The Hand of God is one of my, if not my favorite of his, I think it is, again, recency bias aside, I think it is my favorite at the moment, because I'm conscious these things are always flowing and they're very, very fluid. But no, I'm a huge fan. I'm a complete, I love coming of age movies for one. And I just, there is something about a director who will so candidly tackle an autobiographical moment or series of moments, especially one which is imbued with so much tragedy, that I really, really respect. And other than that, it is just a really sublime and formally interesting in a lot of ways, coming of age. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of trying to speak around a pivotal moment, right, of the film that I found particularly striking. And one was one of the moments in the cinema this year that really, really took my breath away and, you know, like, left my jaw wide open. But no, the film is just, yeah, it's really, really ravishing. I mean, there are all the comparisons that Filippo Scotti, the lead, is getting to Timothy Chalamet, and the film more broadly is kind of getting to Call Me By Your Name, not for the queer aspect, but for, you know, for this being kind of like a sun-kissed Italian coming of Asia. But I think it, but no, as much as the conventional comparison or like the instinctual comparison might be to something like that, I think it really stands on its own 2 feet. As much as I can also appreciate where some have, you know, kind of like indicated some of its problems, because it's a sticky film in a lot of ways. I think it's representation of women, and representation of women's bodies, will polarize. I kind of took it to be the rendering of a juvenile perspective rather than a directorial endorsement. But then I don't know if that's, again, I'm kind of speaking around something here, but I don't know if that's me liking the film so much that I'm overlooking what might be a more glaring issue, but I don't know. But all in all, no, I was a big fan.
I haven't seen the film, but there is certainly a subgenre of Italian, like, coming of age films, which isn't so much from the male gaze as from the horny teenage boy gaze. Is that what you're sort of hinting at there, Jack?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it very much is rooted and stuck in that canon.
Mm-hmm. Hannah, what did you make of the Hand of God?
Yeah, this is where Jack and I massively part ways, because I hated this film, which is quite a strong reaction to have to a Sorrentino film. I don't know. I think he is quite a divisive director. Not that he does anything particularly shocking. I think he just is very old school, and he's a randy bastard, is Sorrentino. All of his work, you know, it's just like boobs, boobs, boobs. And like Jack says, I think maybe you can forgive it a little bit in The Hand of God, because it is about a, is he, what, 16, 17-year-old, and they are horny by default. So, you know, there's a lot of, like, very early on, there's this incredibly, like, lustful shot of a woman just, like, standing waiting for a bus, and it's... I was like, oh, okay, it's going to be one of those films. I should have known better, really, because it's Sorrentino. But, yeah, I think that's my big issue with him, and you can't really get away from it in his work, is that he is a lech, and he reminds me of that in, if any of our listeners have seen the film Spy, the Paul Feig film, there's a character played by Peter Serafinowicz, he's like an Italian spy, and he just keeps saying to Melissa McCarthy, "You have the most wonderful bosom," and that is what Sorrentino reminds me of. It grew very tiring very quickly for me to see this man being so kind of like self-satisfied with his horniness. And there's a bit early on as well that really, like, really angered me, where we're introduced to this character. He uses a vocal modulator because he can't speak. And I just think the film is incredibly cruel about people, about women for a start, but also about people with disabilities, people who are fat. It's just, I don't like his sense of humour. I don't find it funny. I guess maybe it's a culture thing as well, because he is you know, he is Italian, and I think he's very kind of old school Italian, very like Pasolini about his Italian, very actually I think Fellini is what he's going for at all times, but it doesn't cut for me. It's kind of like a poor imitation. But the other thing this film does, it really angers me when they do it in coming of age films, and there's another film that's coming out this year, George Clooney's The Tender Bar, which does it as well, is where you have a coming of age film and there's a character, you know, that the protagonist has a dream, and they just keep talking about the dream and they don't ever do anything to achieve the dream. And in The Tender Bar, it's writing, and in The Hand of God, it's filmmaking. And Fabietta keeps saying, I want to be a filmmaker, I want to make the movies, but he never like does anything. He just like keeps saying it, like that's how you become a filmmaker. You don't have any, and this starts quite late in the film, is suddenly you keep seeing him like kind of engage with there's a filmmaker shooting his film locally, and you see him kind of going to the set to like perv on this actress he likes, and that's the extent of like his filmmaking ambition. And it just really annoys me when you have a storyteller who thinks you can just tell the audience that this ambition is important to a character without actually ever showing them doing any work around it. Yeah, that's like, it's something I one of my like personal pet peeves in a film. I'm just like, well, do it then. Like, if you want to be a filmmaker, do it. Don't just keep telling everyone you want to be a filmmaker. But I will say that the lead actor, whose name escapes me, young Italian Chalamet, is very good. He's definitely one to watch. But yeah, overall, it was a slog for me. The Old Hand of God.
Wow, well, it has been a long while since we've had such a polarizing film on truth and movies. But Jack, let's put some scores on this, and any final comments on The Hand of God.
Yeah, sure. So I would say a 3 going in. Not I do really like Sorrentino, but I think whenever somebody's bringing up that moment, the Hand of God moment, it just kind of like sends a chill down my spine. I never want to think of Maradona ruining the World Cup for us back in the 80s. But I'd take a bit of 5 and a 4. Because I have called in retrospect, because of the very salient observations brought up by other writers, and the more I think about it, the more I find it difficult to reconcile those elements without overstating my own kind of proclivities. But I do think it's really important to note like the central relationship, the familial relationship that's at the core, we haven't really talked about, but between Filippo Scotti's lead and then his parents, which is so, so important. That's the emotional through line of the film and is the thing that's so impactful. Again, I'm speaking around a very critical moment, which I think is one of the most impactful scenes I've experienced in the cinema this year. I liked it a lot.
Hannah, I think your opinion differs slightly.
Yeah, I do agree with Jack. This, I know what scene he's talking about, and I do think that is a really great scene, but for me it's not enough to kind of justify the rest of the film. And I think every time I thought that it was going like to go and kind of pick up and maybe go somewhere I was excited about, it just he kept driving down that road to horny town. So yeah, it's like a 3-2-2 for me. He just doesn't, 17 doesn't really do much for me. Sorry.
Well, listeners, if you're Team Hannah or Team Jack on The Hand of God, let us know at the usual channels. Up next, we have Film Club. And since the BFI are giving a festive re-release to the shop around the corner, it's a great time to reassess a classic. If you've not seen it before, here is the synopsis for The Shop Around the Corner. In a large shop in Budapest, it's the busy run-up to Christmas. A couple of driven sales staff are in competition with each other, yet they're also, unwittingly, in an anonymous romantic relationship, which until now has been conducted purely by letter. James Stewart and Margaret Sullivan play the feuding shop clerks in this Christmas favourite from the legendary director Ernst Lubitsch. So yes, The Shop Around the Corner. Hannah, was this a first watch for you?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I've heard about this film a lot from many different people who've recommended it, but I just never kind of got around to it. And so I was excited to kind of fill in a blank spot, get a new Christmas movie to add to my roster. And what a charming film this is. I was so taken with it in a way I don't think I was really expecting to be. the kind of like the big reveal, which, you know, very early on you kind of learn what's happening, but the big reveal at the end is so moving. But yeah, I think it's a kind of very saliently captures the monstrous reality of working in retail at Christmas, which is just not fun on any level. But yeah, the kind of core relationship between Margaret Sullivan and James Stewart is so charming to watch. They really are like, they fight like cat and dog, but you're like, oh, come on, you're gonna get it together at the end. And yeah, it was just very, very pleased that I finally made time for it, because I think it is a not overtly kind of throwing Christmas in your face type film, which I appreciate as well, because I think sometimes it can be a bit much when you've got, you know, Santas and snow and carols all the time. It's a very kind of, you could watch it any time of year if you wanted to. It's just a great romantic comedy about that archetypal tale of as old as time, two enemies kind of falling for each other.
Yeah, this was, I talk quite often on this podcast about rainy day films where I know that one day I'll get to them, I know that I'll enjoy them, and I'll just save them for the perfect opportunity to. And The Shop Around the Corner was always one for me. I'm a big fan of James Stewart's work elsewhere, particularly with Hitchcock. I've seen other Lubitsch films, and he's talked so much about being a pivotal screenwriter by the more humanistic writers and filmmakers of the 70s and beyond. They always look back to him as having a sort of wisdom to human relationships within the comedy genre. And this one's held up as being a pivotal classic rom-com. And not to suddenly go all Eli Wallach in The Holiday about this, but it does fix so many of the genre, you know, the genre tropes. You know, quite early on here, the meet cute, the great lie, the feuding, quarrelling lovers who unwittingly are really in love with each other, and then the final moment where their love is revealed, and it's all there, but it's also much more complex and has much more going for it than just simply that. I love the fact that in a very of the period style, it's got quite a compact structure that really you're willing them by the end to reveal to each other their real identities, and it's only really in the closing seconds of the film you know that the runtime is ticking away, and you're like, how are they going to resolve this? And they finally do. But also there are multiple other plot lines going on. It very much is about the shop around the corner and all of the assistants and the clerks, and then the manager and the owner, all of them have their own little story in the run-up to Christmas. So it's quite a feast of a film, as well as being a great rom-com that, of course, would go on to inspire You've Got Mail in the 1990s. Jack, what did you make of this?
Oh, I'm a huge fan. I caught it for the first time last year, actually, because I had a bit of a James Stewart marathon. I caught up on lots of different films of his that I hadn't seen, so I saw this. I saw The Philadelphia Story for the first time. I think I saw Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and all these wonderful films. And he's just terrific. Again, I mean, I think you've nailed it so much insofar as why it works is this wonderful rom-com. But also, just like, and I think this rings true for so many films of that era. You know, just like the dialogue has this like snappy and lyrical cadence to it, which just is so engrossing and is just so enjoyable just to like listen to. I really do like it. It was funny as well, because when I saw it last year, I was kind of like, oh my god, nobody told me. I tweeted and I was like, oh my god, nobody told me that James Stewart had done a Christmas film, completely blanking on the existence of the other major James Stewart Christmas film, which I have also seen since and also enjoyed. But I would go so far as to say that The Shop Around the Corner actually supersedes it in a way. I think it's a bit more contained, like you said, and just has this like real warmth and Christmassy, you know, hot chocolatey gooiness to it. I really am a big fan.
I love how you point out the screenplay and the witty, almost screwball dialogue that they have, because it does contrast how the both characters do have these two languages that they're speaking, which is the language on the page, is one where they're quoting from French literature and romance and poetry, but then in real life they're just sniping at each other with these wonderful witty put-downs and comebacks, and having those two conversations running in parallel throughout the film is really such a treat. I love James Stewart, but also Margaret Sullavan is so great in this. Not an actress I know particularly well outside of this film now, but a real discovery for me. But listeners, The Shop Around the Corner is getting a re-release from the British Film Institute this week, so do track it down if you want to kick off your festive season in style. We'll also be back in the next couple of episodes with more festive favourites from the team to recommend to you. But that's it for this week. Jack, Hannah, thank you so much for joining me. It's been such a treat talking through those films with you. Listeners, let us know what you make of the films that we've been talking about this week at the usual channels, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us @LWLies. Next week, Steven Spielberg is remaking a classic musical, West Side Story. We also have the new Adam McKay film, Don't Look Up. And we have a double header of film clubs next week, as our guests have both recommended a Christmas movie. We have The Polar Express and the horror movie Jack Frost. Listeners, please subscribe wherever you pod. If your podcast player of choice lets you leave reviews as well, we'd love you to leave one for us. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Truth and Movies is a Little Dot Studios production for Little White Lies. It's hosted by me, Michael Leader, produced by Jake Cunningham and Harold McShiel, and edited by Steph Watts and James Payne.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.